Well, it's no surprise, but we're in the middle of the Christmas season, right? And that's good, right? We've got music, we've got lights, we've got special shows. The church puts on a lot of things. So that's nice. I like that. I just picked up the downstairs. They have the Good News and the Christian Times, so I'm going to see what's going on in the county for Christmas time. And I was thinking about what Sharon and I do. This is my wife Sharon over here, if you haven't met her before. Definitely the better half. So when we put our tree up and do some of our decorating around our house, we get a little Mannheim Steamroller Christmas music going. Any other Mannheim fans in here? Okay. Yeah, all right. Amazing. First time I heard them was about 20 years ago, and I said, what is this? It was like they took all the Christmas songs, and somehow they sound brand new. And they don't cheapen them, they're just different. And so take a listen sometime if you ever have a chance. Well, one of the things that Christians like to do, especially at Christmas time, is to do Advent. Some of you probably go through the verses in the Old Testament that talk about the coming of Jesus. And I started thinking about that. Of course, that's the Christian view, right? We look at those Old Testament verses and we say, well, that's pretty obvious, right? Those things had to do with Jesus. And you read the New Testament and people like Matthew would go back and they'd say, as it was spoken of in the Scriptures, right? They'd go back to Isaiah or someplace, Amos or whatever it was. They'd say, see? See? And they kept bringing this up and talking about Jesus. Well, is that a universal way of looking at those verses, though? In other words, what would the Jewish perspective be on these verses? Did they see them this way? Or did they see them completely different and Christians have just misinterpreted those verses over the years? So I thought it might be interesting to see from a slightly different angle today. I'm going to get a lot of my material from just a super book. It's called The Search for Messiah. And what it does is it looks at these verses. It's just incredibly complete. I don't have the time. I'm just going to do a few of them. And it says, all right, what did the verses say? What was the Jewish interpretation of these verses, both before Jesus and after Jesus? And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. This is The Search for Messiah. I hope it's still out. This is probably 10 years old or 12 years old now. So we're going to take a look at that. But we've got to do a little bit of background first, because I'm going to be referring a couple of times during the message this morning about some Jewish terms. I just want to make sure you're comfortable with the terms. One is Septuagint and the other is the Talmud. And some of you probably already know about that, but quick history here, if that's okay. I'm a history nut, so I'm going to work history into anything if I can. Roughly 330 BC, Alexander the Great came on the scene and conquered just about everything he had a chance to conquer. Do you know how far he went to the east? Anybody know? India. He made it to India. Coming out of northern Greece, knocking off the Persian Empire, going down into Egypt, knocking off any armies there that were causing him problems, founding city after city after city as he moved across the country, clear out to India, started thinking of himself as a god. And his army guys are going, you're not a god. But he got a fever on the way back, probably combined with all of his wounds and stuff. He was always the first one to leap that wall and to get himself into trouble, and all his army had to kind of follow along behind him. Amazing guy. I mean, what a life. They have a lot of good DVDs on his life that Sharon and I have watched. Well, one of the things that came about as a byproduct, I guess you'd say, was he spread the Greek culture every place he went. He was kind of an egotist, I guess, and so every city was Alexandria, right? So the best known is the one in Egypt, but there are other Alexandrias kind of sprinkled all over the place. And so what happened was the Greek culture just was all over the world at that time, at least the cultured world of the West that we know of. So as a result, we have Hebrews that are sitting there with their scrolls that are in just the Hebrew language, but they're all over the world too, aren't they? They're not in the land of Egypt, in the land of Palestine anymore. They've been kicked out, and some of them have come back, but basically they're spread all over the place. And so here are their kids growing up, and here's actually some of them growing up, and they don't know necessarily all of the Hebrew that they ought to know, and they thought, boy, that'd be great if we could put the Hebrew Old Testament, they would call it their scriptures, if we could put that into the Greek language. And so that was called the Septuagint. It happened about 230 or 240 somewhere. It was a period of time where a bunch of scholars got together. They got the name, by the way, from the story is, we don't know, but supposedly 70 scholars got together, and then Septuagint means 70, I guess, in Greek. And if you ever look it up online, sometimes you'll see it written out as LXX, which is Roman numeral for 70. So if you ever see LXX, you're going, what is this? That's the Septuagint, right? So this is the Bible that Jesus knew. Right? Because that was very popular in that portion of the world, was to have this Bible. So Jesus knew the Septuagint. And so we want to look at what did the Septuagint say? Because keep in mind, this was written, translated, I guess we'd say, from the Hebrew before the time of Jesus. So we can look at some of the prophecies and say, how did the Septuagint translate that? Because we're going to see as we go through this that some of the Jewish leaders who were very uncomfortable as the time of Jesus came and afterwards, when they saw those verses that looked so obviously about Jesus, they wanted to start changing them. And so I'm going to show you some of the changes that happened along the way. But if you clear away all that change and all that upheaval of the time of Jesus, and you go back to like 200 plus BC and take a look and say, what did the Septuagint really say? And I think it'll be interesting to talk about that. And then the other word down there in your list is Talmud. Anybody know what the Talmud is? You've heard of it, right? I mean, it's one of those words that gets around. Okay, the Talmud was something that the... let's take something as obvious as keep the Sabbath holy, right? One of the commandments. So they've got that in their holy scriptures, right? Keep the Sabbath day holy. But of course, a lot of people would scratch their heads and say, but what does that mean? What do I do to keep it holy? You know, can I work? Remember, they're always after Jesus saying, wait a minute, you're doing this thing on the Sabbath. Wait a minute, you're doing this, right? It's the wrong day to do that. Hey, you're healing on the Sabbath. Hey, you're doing this. So the Jewish leaders, the rabbis, the leading rabbis, eventually started making comments and writing them down about what they thought that the scriptures meant. And that's called the Talmud. And they've done it over a long period of time. They have different groupings of these things. So I'm going to be referring to the Talmud, which came along a little bit later, and you'll see what they had to say about some of these prophecies about Jesus. So does that make sense as far as the Talmud? And
So the Talmud is a book.
Yeah, it's a collection of rabbis having opinions and comments and trying to understand, kind of like we have commentaries today. And of course, those commentaries, you've got to be a little careful on, don't you? Because it's just the opinion of whoever wrote the commentary. It's just their view of Scripture. It's good to have a commentary. But yeah, so these are just various commentaries that are out. They came along different time periods, and for hundreds and hundreds of years, they were accumulating these. I think you can buy them now. There's one that's like 1,000 pages, you know, because it's a lot of time period there where they're talking about their scriptures. So just as long as those two things make sense. Well, let's pick up on one of the more famous of the passages. I bet you know where I'm going, Isaiah 53. And I'd like to read a portion of it. Not the entire chapter. And have us think about, what would the Jews come up with? How would they interpret these verses in here? So one person I heard one time call Isaiah the fifth gospel. Because you think about how many of the New Testament writers pulled things out of Isaiah. Right? So much of it seems appropriate to the life of Jesus. And in 53... I want to take you just to a portion. Let's look at verse 4 through 6. Actually, I'm going to continue a little bit past that. It says, surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death. Though he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Why does that sound like Jesus?
It is Jesus. It's talking about Jesus. It's talking about the good news that is to come.
Yeah. Give me some specifics there. What about the life or the death or anything that you can think of as far as Jesus goes? Where do you see the foreshadowing in here?
taking all the sin on him.
Yeah, sure.
Verse 6b.
The Lord laid on him, right, that part? Yeah, the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. What else sounds like the famous Passion story that we all know? So, okay, it doesn't specifically mention the kind of death, does it? But it says he was cut off from the land of the living. So being cut off doesn't sound like something that was dying of old age, right? Something is happening to this person.
Yeah, because he was led like a lamb to the slaughter.
Okay, led like a lamb to the slaughter. It says, yet he did not open his mouth. Did you notice that? I mean, you'd think if you're being put on trial or some kind of death coming up that you'd be saying, wait a minute, you got the wrong person, or this is not right, or if I'm going to go down, at least let me have one last speech or something. But it says, led like a lamb before, led like a lamb to the slaughter.
And that he would die, because it talks about his grave.
Yeah.
Being buried with the rich.
That's odd, isn't it? It says he was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. So there's something odd going on there. Of course, if you read the New Testament, then you got the picture of Jesus dying with the thieves, but being buried in a rich person's tomb. But that must have seemed odd at the time to see that wickedness and the rich together. Yes?
This is like a trailer for the New Testament.
It's like a trailer, you said? Yeah. That's a little movie slang there, huh? Yeah. Well, what have the Jews done with this? Well, one possibility that they've gone with, and I want to see what your thoughts are, that this was not referring to a Messiah, that this was actually referring to the nation of Israel itself, that it's been continually at war, that it's been picked on, that it's been abused, that the nations have turned on it and have put them through just utter misery, which of course we do know is true. To me, it's always been a sign of demonic activity that the Jews get picked on all the time for everything. But do you see anything in here that we just read that you would say, well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense?
Talks about his appearance.
Okay.
And so that's a person. It's not...
I agree. Yeah. What else?
Verse 3 says, a man of sorrow.
That's true. I didn't read that, did I? Yeah, man of sorrows. But, you know, sometimes maybe they'd say, well, this is symbolic language. But you sure have to throw out a lot if this is going to be symbolic. Yes.
Are they worshiping him and accepting him as Lord and Savior?
You mean today?
No.
Or back in this?
In this talk.
Well, it doesn't look like he's being accepted here, does it? No. But the Jews would say neither are we. Right? So they're trying to build some kind of connection or comparison here that we have been rejected, we have suffered, we have been led to our death.
So they didn't think he was a special man.
Are you talking about how the Jews saw the Messiah?
Yes. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we're going to pick on that one, especially coming up with another verse. We'll get to that in just a second.
There's a contrast here also between the people, we, and whoever they're talking about, him. So it's hard to, you know, there is that difference. So how they tie it together as the same person is amazing.
Yeah.
How would they resolve the payment for iniquity?
Yeah, since when? I mean, how do other nations benefit morally or, you know, spiritually from killing Jews? I mean, a guy like Hitler, of course, he liked the idea, but I mean, there isn't the idea that somehow it elevates the spirit of somebody or the soul of somebody to take these people out. And plus it says, led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shears is silent, so he didn't open his mouth. That's not the Jewish people.
I didn't think that it could elevate them. Right.
What?
How can it elevate a people to kill and slaughter a man?
Right. That seems so odd. Sure?
I was just wondering, Israel is usually considered she.
Well, yeah, there are other images of brides, bridegroom, and a bride.
Yeah, this says he.
Yeah, this says he. Okay. So I think there's a lot of problems. There are a lot of problems if we try to interpret it as the nation. And so what's happened is some Jews have just simply taken Isaiah 53 out of their Bibles. Well, that's one way to take care of it. Got a problem just under the rug, right? Yeah, I read that the other day, and I read it twice. I said, what? That's just amazing. But, of course, it's in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and if you go back far enough, it's in the Septuagint, for heaven's sakes. So all you have to do is say, let's go back to the Septuagint. Let's see what's in the Septuagint. This was pre-Jesus. There's no reason for them to have worried about it because they didn't know Jesus was coming. And it's in there. So it seems like that's kind of a problem for them. Can we take a look at Psalm 22, please? You'll recognize the first line. And again, I'm going to skip around a little bit. Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Of course, we know that from the lines of Jesus on the cross, don't we? But let me pick up in verse 7. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Of course, that's sarcastic, isn't it? Let's go to verse 14. I'm poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is turned to wax. It's melted away within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing.
Is this David speaking?
This is David.
Sounds like David.
This is David 1000 BC. So we're talking 1,000 years go by, and then the time of Jesus comes. Tell me some things, again, you've heard out of the Passion story that you can hear going on 1000 BC. What did Jesus go through that this is foreshadowing, that we would say as Christians?
Yeah, pierce my hands and my feet.
Okay, piercing. There was no crucifixion during this time. They had a lot of interesting ways of putting you to death, but that wasn't one. It's the Romans, as far as I know, that came up with the idea of crucifixion. But it says they pierced my hands and my feet. Sounds like crucifixion, which is amazing if this is truly prophetic, right? 1,000 years before the Romans got busy with that devilish idea. What else sounds familiar in here with the story of Jesus? What's that?
Casting lots for his clothing.
Yeah, the casting lots for the clothing.
All bones being out of joint.
Yeah, I mean it's awful to think about, but if you're hanging on a cross, your weight is pulling yourself down, and the shoulder bones are being pulled, and so you've got to, and you can't breathe, so you've got to push up with your foot to get another breath of air, because your lungs can't refill when you're in that position. So you've got the tongue sticking to the roof of the mouth. Jesus says, I thirst, when he's on the cross. So much of that sounds familiar. People mocking him. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? I even thought about my heart has turned to wax. You know, they did the spear in the side, and you have the mixture of the, probably the plasma separating already from the blood itself, which, I don't know, maybe that's reading way more physiology in there than we should, but a lot of this sounds very, very familiar, doesn't it, to us as Christians? Well, the Jews, the recent ways that they have tried to interpret this, and maybe your Bible has, does it have a little note on the part, they have pierced my hands and my feet? Really? Mine has a little tiny note.
What verse is that?
Verse 16, the last part.
Some Hebrew manuscripts.
Yeah, some Hebrew manuscripts. Apparently that phrase about they have pierced my hands and my feet is fairly close to another Hebrew phrase, which is like a lion. Okay, so in other words, this is the way Jewish Bibles are going to translate this part now. Let me read back to verse 16. Dogs have surrounded me, a band of evil men has encircled me like lions, like a lion. So what's happened there? Well, they've taken out the reference to the piercing, right? Because that sounds so prophetic, 1,000 years before the Romans did it. Well, here we go again. Guess what's in the Septuagint? They pierced my hands and my feet. Okay, so if the best Jewish scholars, and this is your way to counteract that, I think, if the best Jewish scholars, before Jesus entered, before everything got colored with who's Jesus, do you believe in him or not, 200 BC, they're looking at these verses, they're looking at their Hebrew scriptures, these are Hebrews themselves doing this, and they translate it, pierced my hands and my feet. So I'm going to go with the Septuagint. All right, does that make sense? I mean, just, that's good, that's
that
good scholarship.
That was done, this piercing?
No, they didn't do that back in 1000.
Bringing men up on the cross?
Yeah, that was not till the Roman times. Yeah.
I think he's saying it's not something that would be speculated.
Right.
Given knowledge.
It was a totally new form of punishment.
New form of punishment.
Yeah, way after David. So for David to come up with this is we would say supernatural. And I think the Septuagint bears that out as well. Okay, let's try another one. I'm having you skip back, I guess. I probably should have put these in a different order. Can we go back to Isaiah? This is one that we like a lot at Christmas time, especially. Isaiah 9, verse 6. And if you like Handel's Messiah, you're allowed to hum along as I read this, okay? But I'm not going to sing it. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Isn't that powerful? And that is part of Handel's Messiah. I don't know how many of you actually listened to Handel's Messiah, but all he did was thread together a bunch of Old and New Testament passages. It's really powerful. It's just an amazing testimony to Jesus Christ. And this is one of them, right? This is one of the more famous of the parts that everybody sings. Well, look what's being described there. Can I just take part of that again? Great, so a child is born. So what? We get a son. So what? The government's going to be on his shoulders. Well, that could be just about anybody, huh? But how about this last part? He will be called, and this is the part that's going to be crucial. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, comma. Do you have a comma with your Bible? Mighty God, another comma, meaning here comes a second phrase that's going to be attached to him. Everlasting Father, and another
that's
comma.
Prophecy.
Sure. And Prince of Peace. Those were four statements, right? And what does that suggest to you? Does this suggest any old person?
No.
This sounds supernatural, doesn't it?
Yes.
This son, right? This son that will be given is not going to be any kind of regular old person, right? This is somebody that's got all sorts of special attached names to him. So the question is, well, was that what was originally there? Because if you, and I did this the other day just to double check. I went online, typed in Jewish scriptures. Here's what it says. I'm going to read it, but the basic thing is they're going to throw some prepositions in there, right? I'm an English teacher. So don't worry. I mean, if you don't get prepositions, I understand. My students don't either. So, and we're in the 16th week of the semester, so I don't know what's going on there. But all right. But if you play with a language just a little bit, you can make a huge difference. So let me read that part in the modern Jewish translation. What will he be called? Last phrase there. Wonderful Counselor of the Mighty God. There's the preposition. Comma. Of the Everlasting Father. Comma. Of the Prince of Peace. Now, isn't that a huge difference? I mean, just think about it one more time. Let me read the original. He'll be called what? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. These are the names that he'll have. Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. But what about this? Wonderful Counselor of God. Wonderful Counselor of the Father. Wonderful Counselor of the Prince of Peace. How does that change?
So now he's not the last three things. He's just a counselor.
Yeah, of, meaning he's a representative of. He's God's counselor, but he's not God.
That could be like
Noah. He's, what's that?
That could be like Dennis. Dennis,
sure.
He's a representative of God.
Yeah. So look what they've done. They've stripped out the deity. They've stripped out this amazing difference that we would say this child represents. And he's just a symbol of God. He'll carry the name that I honor God. I represent the Prince of Peace. I represent him as a mighty counselor. Isn't that amazing? It's completely different.
How recent is that? If you go back to the Old Testament, is that how they?
No, except, well, I'm going to read you something here in just a second.
So I was curious, when did that change take place?
I don't know, but it was after Jesus.
No, I was thinking it was even, maybe not more than a couple of, maybe a century ago.
Yeah.
Less.
It could be.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if you look it up online sometime, it'll say, and his name will be called, and then it shifts to a big, long Hebrew word. Now, I didn't even write that out because it take me forever. I'm a terrible typist. It's just huge. But it translates to what I just told you, the of. All right, well, so now we're kind of stuck, right? We say, well, we don't know what's going on here because we're not scholars. Okay, so I went online. Here's a Hebrew scholar, Dr. James Price, professor of Hebraic studies. The Septuagint, sounds familiar, translates the expression, his name is called. And even the Tanakh, which is their Old Testament, says he will be called Wonderful Counselor, and then all of a sudden it says the Jewish part says the of. And here's what he says. Their insertion of the word of is not justified by any rule of Hebrew grammar. None. In the Talmud, the verse is translated, his name will be called Wonderful, comma, Counselor, comma, etc., etc. So the original, right, we're going back again. What did the, not only the Septuagint say, what did the Talmud say when they were investigating this and talking about it? They agreed, that's what it said. So it's only the modern Jewish Bible that's decided, let's take that little of and throw that in there. Isn't that weird? Just one little word, of, and you've got Jesus stripped of any kind of deity. That's amazing what you can do with language, huh? People always say, oh, language doesn't matter. Let's be sloppy on language. Oh, no. Right? That's why I think it's important, right? So here you go. You take one little twist, and all of a sudden you've gotten rid of the deity of Jesus. Let's take a look at 3 and 4. This part gives me the chills. I love this a lot. This is looking at dating of the Messiah, right? People were looking at crunching some numbers. I'll show you how and where that worked out. All right, so let's talk about some of the verses that gave some dates for the Messiah coming. And how did the Jews interpret that? Again, somebody's going to say, well, that's just you Christians playing with numbers. You're just crunching numbers that work out okay for you. So we'll see. Because of time, I think I'll skip the Haggai verse, but you can look it up sometime. It's pretty interesting. Let's go to Genesis 49. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the verse, we're going to understand what we think it means as Christians, and then we'll take a look and see what the Jewish reaction is. What did they think of these verses? Are we totally off base translating it and picturing it the way we picture it? So chapter 49, if you recognize, this is Jacob. He's gathered his sons and he's blessing them before he dies. And you know one of the sons got a special blessing, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Who is that? Do you know?
Judah
especially, right? He's going to get all sorts of blessings here in just a second. So here's Judah. And by the way, something interesting to keep in mind, the Messiah's lineage is laid out all through the Old Testament, isn't it? Doesn't he have to come through the line of Judah? Well, what did anybody know what happened in 70 AD? The Romans knocked down everything, including any way to keep track of your lineage. Because all the records, everything's gone. So there's no way a Jew today can say, I'm the Messiah. People would say, well, look, you know, there are all these references. Can you trace your lineage through the tribe of Judah? And they're going to say, no, not really. So I think that's kind of interesting, first of all. But here we go. So chapter 49, verse 9. Okay, you're a lion's cub, O Judah. So here he turns, he's talking to Judah. You return from the prey like a lion. You crouch, you lie down. But this is the part that I wanted to have you read. Verse 10. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. So we know who that's talking about. Sometimes it's translated as Shiloh, but it's talking about the Messiah there, until the Messiah comes. But that early part is a little fuzzy, isn't it? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Anybody ever done any research on that verse, or you've got a note maybe down below in your Bible, if you have a study Bible? What's that business about a scepter not departing and the ruler's staff?
It says, or until Shiloh comes, or until he comes to whom tribute belongs.
Okay. Well, let me take that first part, because this is how the Jews translated it, or interpreted it, right? So this is not a Christian view. This, again, is from the Talmud. They said that phrase, the scepter will not depart and the ruler's staff will not depart until Shiloh comes. So what they meant by that was Judah, the Jews in general, will have the power to control their own government to the point that they will be able to control capital punishment, right? Isn't that the ultimate thing, that you have the right of life or death over your own people? If that's taken away from you, in a sense, your scepter, your rule has been snapped over somebody's knee. And did you know the Jews had the right to their own capital punishment until right after the Romans took over and Herod was king? Then Herod dies and one of his sons comes along and he's kind of a jerk. Well, the whole family, that's one of the worst families in history. That makes soap operas look pretty tame if you ever read about the Herods. Anyway, the Romans got sick of the Herod family and they took away, I think it was 6 or 7 AD, they took away the right of the Jews to have capital punishment. And so you know that, don't you? Because when Jesus is grabbed, the Jews don't take him out and put him to death. They got to run it past the Romans, right? They say, you've got to make the decision. Pilate didn't care. He didn't really want to do it, but the Jews kept saying, okay, you're the one that has to do it. So why was that? Because about 25 years or so before then, Rome, for the very first time, took away the Jewish right to do this, to have capital punishment. And the Jews, and this is the part that I think is really interesting, they knew what was going on. And in one of their Talmuds, which was like 200 AD, one of their written out commentary about the Messiah, they said, woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah and the Messiah has not come. Do you hear that? I'm going to do it one more time. So this is a Jew looking back, thinking about this business about losing the right to capital punishment, looking back in Genesis. They put the two together and they said, woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah. You know, that happened because of the Romans, and the Messiah has not come. So do you see how they expected the Messiah would come at that moment when that scepter business was going on? And sure enough, in 6 or 7 AD, Jesus was growing up. And so Messiah did come. We believe that, don't we? Messiah did come when the Romans finally snapped that scepter and said, you no longer have the right to capital punishment, which means this verse is accurate, right? The scepter will not depart from Judah until he comes. So 6 or 7 AD, there goes the right to capital punishment. And who's growing up? About 10-year-old kid at the time? Jesus. So this works exactly right. And the Jews themselves recognize that he should have come when we lost our right to capital punishment. So they say, woe is us, right? Woe unto us. Let's take the one that is the real hoot to take a look at, and that's the one in Daniel. By the way, while you're all turning, this is Daniel 9. Does somebody have like a calculator, a phone calculator that you can do a quick number crunch for me? Ben, do you?
I'll have to get into it.
Oh, that's all right. I sprung it on you. I shouldn't have.
I'll probably have to find it to leave.
Okay. That's right. I can just tell you the numbers, and then you're just going to have to trust me and go home and mess with it yourself. All right. Meanwhile, while we're looking for that, can we take a look at what I'm talking about here? Daniel 9. You probably know where I'm going with this. Remember, we're in the section about trying to figure out when Messiah is going to come, looking at the time period here. So I'm in Daniel 9. 25. Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, that would be the Messiah, the ruler comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who come will destroy the city and the sanctuary and on, right? Some bad news there. But it's that sevens, that business of sevens. Have you heard people talk about that before when they've talked prophecy and all? Okay. Anybody have a calculator yet? Or you?
483.
Oh.
Okay, pretty fast there.
I must have been in one of your classes before.
Well, it's going to get you off a little bit. Because I mean, go back and do you have your... How'd you do that?
That was a note.
Oh, it's a note. Okay.
In my Bible, I was saying, you probably gave it to me.
Oh, okay. Well, let's try that. Here's what you're going to have to do if you want to try to get close, because this is interesting. First of all, it says there's going to be 69 sevens, and then Messiah comes, right? So 69, everybody interprets those sevens as times of years. So you got to multiply 69 times 7. Right, so that's step one.
483.
All right, but we're not done. Okay, next step. The Jews, along with a whole lot of people during this time period, had 360-day years. So Daniel's talking 360-day years. And here's where the calculator is going to be useful. Multiply 360 times the 483. Okay, you should get 173, 880. Okay. Now, for us today to make sense of this, we got to retranslate this, right? So now we're in 360-day years. Take that figure and divide by 365, because that's what we live in.
476.
Okay, 476. Now, there's some people that get really into this, and they've got it down to actually, you know, how many leap years occurred and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not doing that, right? That's just way too much. But now the question is, what decree is he talking about? Do you have any notes on yours? There was a decree.
Artaxerxes' decree, wasn't it?
Artaxerxes. Right, Artaxerxes. What's going on? Nehemiah goes to Artaxerxes, who's a Persian king. Right, the people have been pulled away by the Babylonians, but the Babylonians fell. The Persians took over, and now they're far more lenient people. The Assyrians and the Babylonians are pretty bad news. If they didn't like you, you're in major trouble. The Persians were much more enlightened. So Nehemiah goes to Artaxerxes and said, "Can we go back? Can we build our city?" And he says, "Yes." And he does a royal decree. That's where you get the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah and the trying to rebuild the city, which is just a mess from the Babylonians. So that was 445 BC. So now we can work some numbers out here. 445 BC to zero is, of course, 445 years. Jesus' death occurs because it says the anointed one's going to get cut off. Jesus' death, most people think, is 30 or 31 BC, something like that. So you add those two up, and what do you get? The number that Ben just did, right? Would you?
476.
476. That takes you to 31 AD. So you say, well, okay, you're just playing number games here, right? This is just a Christian trick here, right? It's like, watch this card, you know, and I'm going to manipulate or something. That's not the case. What was the Jewish reaction to this? And by the way, this is sort of an aside, but you know how many times Jesus kept saying, "My hour has not yet come"? Remember that? This is just my view, and I read it someplace, and I certainly don't expect you to buy into it necessarily, but I always thought he's thinking about the Daniel prophecy, and he's got the timeline all figured out, and he knows that this isn't going to work out if people take him and make him king or put him to death a year or two earlier. Does that make sense? Because he's got to be the fulfillment of this Daniel prophecy. And if he's off by a year or two, then people will scratch their heads. But anyway, here's the Jewish reaction. I think this is fascinating. Have you heard of the Qumran community that was out by the Dead Sea? That's where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. There were a bunch of people that just pulled out of Jerusalem, didn't want to live with everybody, wanted to sit out there. Do you know they wrote again and again, they thought that was the time period that the Messiah was coming because they used this Daniel prophecy? So we're not the only ones, right? The Qumran community believed that. Here's the Talmud. 200 to 500 AD, part of this Jewish opinion writing was done. Here's what it says, direct quote out of it. "These times," meaning Daniel's times, you know, when the Messiah was going to come, "these times were over long ago." Why are they saying it? Because they're 200 or 300 AD and they're looking back and they're saying, according to that timeline, right, it should have been around the 30s, we're way past that now. So they're looking back at it saying, we missed it. Right? What happened to Messiah? Well, they missed it, but we don't. Right. Here's a third one, Maimonides. You can look him up. He's one of the most respected Jewish rabbis of all time. Extremely bright person. He wrote in the 12th century. He told rabbis, don't let your people take this Daniel prophecy and crunch the numbers because they're going to find out that we missed the Messiah. Isn't that interesting? He told the rabbis, don't go there. Don't let people look at this stuff. Don't let them do what we just did with calculators, right? Well, obviously they're not doing calculators, but anyway, he said, don't mess with that, right? Don't figure it out because, quote, "the end times have already come, but there's no sign of the Messiah." Isn't that sad, first of all? I mean, you just hate to think about all those people going, we missed it. How could we miss it? And then they got to reinterpret all this stuff, but it's that first part to say, you know, we missed it. Well, we as Christians say, you missed it, but it was there, right? So again, notice what's going on. These prophecies were fulfilled. And the timeline was what the Jews expected. We're not making this up. We're not playing card games here, right? The Jews themselves, who ought to know their own scriptures, looked for it in the first century. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Well, let's wrap it up here. I just wrote down, there's a great story I wanted to end with here. The Jews, during their high holy days, would have the priest go into the Holy of Holies, and then after he had cleansed himself, he'd come out and put the sins of the nation on an animal and chase it out of the community. Have you heard that story before? That was the scapegoat, right? That's where we get the idea of a scapegoat. And so this animal would go outside of the city, and apparently they would tie a red ribbon around the animal's neck, and then somebody was told to go follow that goat for a period of time. And after a while, we would say it was just the sun bleaching the red ribbon, but that red ribbon would turn white, and that person would come back into the city and say, good news. God took our sins, our red sins, our guilt, and he now looks on us favorably for doing this kind of offering, right? It's white, and people go, whew, you know, we're okay for another year until that happened again. Well, let me take you to the Talmud. One more time, this is 200 to 500 AD. This is when the Jews got together and were writing commentary. This just sends a chill up my spine. Quote, 40 years before the second temple was destroyed, the red wool did not become white. Okay, so run the numbers, right? 40 years from 70 AD, it says 40 years before, we're talking 30, 31 AD. Does that sound familiar? And so the Jews were horrified. They said, what's going on? We sent this animal out, and it stayed red out there. Do you have an explanation for that from a Christian perspective? Why wasn't God doing things the same way he'd done things for hundreds of years?
Because he sent the Messiah.
Jesus, as the book of Hebrews says, that's a sacrifice once done forever. Right? Isn't that amazing? So here are these Jews looking at this, and this is supernatural. Why would something stay red out there? Because God was ordaining this to happen, don't you think? He was saying, it's over, right? I will not accept this kind of sacrifice anymore. I will accept my son's sacrifice. And the Jews themselves, they didn't necessarily tie into Christ, but one more time, this is from 200 or 500, up to 500 AD. 40 years before the second temple was destroyed, the red wool did not become white. And they were frightened or puzzled.
I would like to see their answer to the Holy of Holies,
the curtain and everything. Yeah.
Splitting.
Yeah. Well, they actually make a reference to that apparently in the Talmud too, about the temple doors being open and things like that. So, actually, if you read the Talmud, they actually talked about Jesus. They said he did amazing acts by sorcery. But isn't that interesting that they do reference Jesus? They do admit he did some amazing, miraculous things, but just like the people during his own time period, they said, well, he did it through magic and sorcery. But they had to admit that he did those things. So I just love that to death. I just think that's a terrific way to end. So I hope you enjoy Christmas more, realizing as you go through Advent or whatever, and you notice these things are legitimate ways of looking at the Old Testament. I just put a note at the end here as some sources that you can take a look at. The book, again, one more time, The Search for Jesus. And lots of organizations have these kinds of pamphlets out. If you look under Messianic Jewish different congregations, they're the ones who believe Jesus, but they're Jews and all. And so, good heavens, I got this thing that's called Prophecies in the Tanakh, that's their scriptures, fulfilled by Yeshua the Messiah. And there's just, we only did two or three today. Look how many there are, and it continues on the back. Right? So if you ever want to sit down and talk to somebody who doesn't buy into this stuff, the Old Testament just sings out the name of Jesus all the way through it. Third thing on there, of course, you can contact me if you want, zax@cox.net. But third thing, we have an apologetics class that just ended, but if you're ever interested, contact me and I'll get you on the list. We start again in January. And I've got a website if you're interested through Palomar College. I teach the Bible as literature out there. And I put like 35 or 40 audio lectures on there about the Bible. Now, because it's Palomar, I can't talk really specifically about Christianity. But if you're curious about, you know, things like this, I talk about different parts of the Old Testament and New Testament as well. So you can download some audio files.